The famous doctor. When the family talks about it at all, which is like never, they always begin in the same place. With Abelard and the bad thing he said about Trujillo. Abelard Luis Cabral was Oscar and Lola's grandfather, a surgeon who'd studied in Mexico City in the Lázaro Cárdenas years and in the mid-1940s, before any of us were even born. A man of considerable standing in La Vega. Un hombre muy serio, muy educado, y muy bien plantado. You can already see where this is headed. In those long-ago days, before delinquencia and bank failures, before diaspora, the Cabrals were numbered among the high of the land. They were not as filthy rich or as historically significant as the Ral Cabrals of Santiago, but they weren't too shabby a cadet branch either. In La Vega, where the family had lived since 1791, they were practically royalty, as much a landmark as La Casa Amarilla and the Rio Camus. Neighbors spoke of the 14-room house that Abelard's father had built, Casa Atuey. Atuey, in case you've forgotten, was the Taino Ho Chi Minh. When the Spaniards were committing first genocide in the Dominican Republic, Atuey left the island and canoed to Cuba, looking for reinforcements. His voyage, a precursor to the trip Máximo Gómez would take almost 300 years later. Casa Atuey was named Atuey because in times past, it supposedly had been owned by a descendant of the priest who tried to baptize Atuey right before the Spaniards burned him at the stake. What Atuey said on that pyre is a legend in itself. Are there white people in heaven? Then I'd rather go to hell. History, however, has not been kind to Atuey. Unless something changes ASAP, he will go out like his camarada Crazy Horse, coffled to a beer in a country not his own. Atuey was a rambling, off-expanded villa eclectic whose original stone core had been transformed into Abelard's study, a house bounded by groves of almonds and dwarf mangoes. There was also a modern Art Deco apartment in Santiago, where Abelard often spent his weekends attending the family businesses. The freshly refurbished stables that could have comfortably billeted a dozen horses. The horses themselves, six Berbers with skin like vellum. And of course, the five full-time servants of the Rayano variety. While the rest of the country in that period subsisted on rocks and scraps of yucca, and were host to endless coils of intestinal worms, the Cabrals dined on pastas and sweet Italian sausages, scraped Jalisco silver on flatware from Belique. A surgeon's income was a fine thing, but Abelard's portfolio, if such things existed in those days, was the real source of the family wealth. From his hateful cantankerous father, now dead, Abelard had inherited a pair of prosperous supermercados in Santiago, a cement factory, and titles to a string of fincas in the Septentrionales. The Cabrals were, as you might have guessed, members of the fortunate people. Summers they borrowed a cousin's cabaña in Puerto Plata and decamped there for a period of no less than 3 weeks. Abelard's two daughters, Jacqueline and Astrid, swam and played in the surf, often suffering mulatto pigment degradation disorder, a.k.a. tans, under the watchful gaze of their mother who, unable to risk no extra darkness, remained chained to her umbrella's shadow, while their father, when not listening to the news from the war, roamed the shoreline, his face set in tense concentration. He walked barefoot, stripped down to his white shirt and his vest, his pant legs rolled, his demi-afro and avuncular torch, plump with middle age. Sometimes a fragment of a shell or a dying horseshoe crab could catch Abelard's attention, and he'd get down on all fours and examine it with a gem-cutter's glass, so that to both his delighted daughters, as well as to his appalled wife, he resembled a dog sniffing a turd. There are still those in the Cibao who remember Abelard, and all will tell you that besides being a brilliant doctor, he possessed one of the most remarkable minds in the country. Indefatigably curious, alarmingly prodigious, and especially suited for linguistic and computational complexity. The viejo was widely read in Spanish, English, French, Latin, and Greek. A collector of rare books, an advocate of outlandish abstractions, a contributor to the Journal of Tropical Medicine, and an amateur ethnographer in the Fernando Ortiz mode. Abelard was, in short, a brain. Not entirely uncommon in the Mexico where he had studied, but an exceedingly rare species on the island of Supreme General Rafael Leónidas Trujillo Molina. He encouraged his daughters to read and prepared them to follow him into the profession. They could speak French and read Latin before they were nine. And so keen was he about learning that any new piece of knowledge, no matter how arcane or trivial, could send his ass over the Van Allen belt. His parlor, so tastefully wallpapered by his father's second wife, was hangout number one for the local todologos. Discussions would rage for entire evenings, and while Abelard was often frustrated by the poor quality, nothing like that at the UNAM. He wouldn't have abandoned these evenings for anything. Often his daughters would bid their father goodnight, only to find him the next morning still engaged in some utterly obscure debate with his friends. Eyes red, hair akimbo, woozy but game. They would go to him and he would kiss each in turn, calling them his brillantes. These youthful intelligences, he often boasted to his friends, will best us all. The reign of Trujillo was not the best time to be a lover of ideas. Not the best time to be engaging in parlor debate, to be hosting tertulias, to be doing anything out of the ordinary, but Abelard was nothing if not meticulous. Never allowed contemporary politics, i.e. Trujillo, to be bandied about. Kept shit on the abstract plane. Allowed anybody who wanted, including members of the secret police, to attend his gatherings. Given that you could get lit up for even mispronouncing the failed cattle thief's name, it was a no-brainer, really. As a general practice, Abelard tried his best not to think about El Jefe at all. Followed sort of the Tao of dictator avoidance, which was ironic considering that Abelard was unmatched in maintaining the outward appearance of the enthusiastic Trujillista. But what was even more ironic was that Abelard had a reputation for being able to keep his head down during the worst of the regime's madness. For unseeing, as it were. In 1937, for example, while the Friends of the Dominican Republic were perejiling Haitians and Haitian Dominicans and Haitian-looking Dominicans to death, while genocide was, in fact, in the making, Abelard kept his head, eyes, and nose safely tucked into his books. Let his wife take care of hiding his servants. Didn't ask her nothing about it. And when survivors staggered into his surgery with unspeakable machete wounds, he fixed them up as best as he could, without making any comments as to the ghastliness of their wounds. Acted like it was any other day. Both as an individual and as the executive officer of his medical association, he gave unstintingly to the Partido Dominicano. He and his wife, who was his number one nurse and his best assistant, joined every medical mission that Trujillo organized, no matter how remote the campo. And no one could suppress a guffaw better than Abelard when El Jefe won an election by 103%. What enthusiasm from the pueblo! When banquets were held in Trujillo's honor, Abelard always drove to Santiago to attend. He arrived early, left late, smiled endlessly, and didn't say nothing. Disconnected his intellectual warp engine and operated strictly on impulse power. When the time came, Abelard would shake El Jefe's hand, cover him in the warm effusion of his adoration. If you think the Trujillato was not homoerotic, then to quote the priest, you got another thing coming. And without further ado, fade back into the shadows, a la Oscar's favorite movie, Point Blank. kept as far away from El Jefe as possible. He wasn't under any delusion that he was Trujillo's equal, or his buddy, or some kind of necessary individual. After all, niggers who messed with him had a habit of ending up with a bad case of the deads. It didn't hurt that Abelard's family was not totally in the jefe's pocket, that his father had cultivated no lands or negocios in geographic or competitive proximity to the jefe's own holding. His fuckface contact was blessedly limited. He wished that could also have been the case with his Balaguer contact. In those days, the demon Balaguer had not yet become the election thief, was only Trujillo's minister of education. You can see how successful he was at that job. And any chance he got to corner Abelard, he did. He wanted to talk to Abelard about his theories, which were four parts Gobineau, four parts Goddard, and two parts German racial eugenics. The German theories, he assured Abelard, were all the rage on the continent. Abelard nods. I see. But you ask who was the smarter? No comparison. In a tables and ladders match, Abelard, the cerebro del Cibao, would have 3D'd the genio de genocidio in about 2 seconds flat. Abelard and the failed cattle thief might have glided past each other in the halls of history, if not for the fact that starting in 1944, Abelard, instead of bringing his wife and daughter to jefe events, as custom dictated, began to make a point of leaving them at home. He explained to his friends that his wife had become nervous, and that Jacqueline took care of her. But the real reason for the absences was Trujillo's notorious rapacity and his daughter Jacqueline's off-the-hook looks. Abelard's serious, intellectual oldest daughter was no longer her tall, awkward, flaquita self. Adolescence had struck with a fury, transforming her into a young lady of great beauty. She had caught a serious case of the hips-ass chest, a condition which during the mid-40s spelled trouble with a capital T to the R to the U to the J to the EU. Ask any of your elders and they will tell you Trujillo might have been a dictator, but he was a Dominican dictator, which is another way of saying he was the number one bellaco in the country. Believe that all the Toto and the DR was literally his. It's a well-documented fact that in Trujillo's DR, if you were of a certain class, and you put your cute daughter anywhere near El Jefe, within the week, she'd be mamando his ripio like an old pro, and there would be nothing you could do about it. Part of the price of living in Santo Domingo, one of the island's best-known secrets. So common was the practice, so insatiable Trujillo's appetites, that there were plenty of men in the nation, hombres de caridad y posición, who, believe it or not, offered up their daughters freely to the failed cattle thief. Abelard, to his credit, was not one of them. As soon as he realized what was what, after his daughter started stopping traffic on Calle El Sol, after one of his patients looked at his daughter and said, "You should be careful with that one," he pulled a Rapunzel on her ass and locked her in. It was a brave thing, not in keeping with his character. But he'd only have to watch Jacqueline preparing for school one day. Big in body, but still a child, God damn it, still a child. And the brave thing became easy. Hiding your doe-eyed, large-breasted daughter from Trujillo, however, was anything but easy. Like keeping the ring from Sauron. If you think the average Dominican guy's bad, Trujillo was 5,000 times worse. Dude had hundreds of spies whose entire job was to scour the provinces for his next piece of ass. If the procurement of ass had been any more central to the Trujillato, the regime would have been the world's first culocracy. And maybe in fact it was. In this climate, hoarding your women was tantamount to treason. Offenders who didn't cough up the muchachas could easily find themselves enjoying the invigorating charm of an 8-shark bath. Let us be clear. Abelard was taking an enormous risk. It didn't matter that he was upper class, or that he'd prepared the groundwork well, going as far as having a friend diagnose his wife as manic, then letting the word leak through the elite circles in which he ran. If Trujillo and company caught wind of his duplicity, they'd have him in chains and Jacqueline on her back in 2 seconds flat. Which was why every time El Jefe shuffled down the welcome line, shaking hands, Abelard expected him to exclaim in that high, shrill voice of his, "Dr. Abelard Cabral, where is that delicious daughter of yours? I've heard so much about her from your neighbors." It was enough to make Abelard febrile. His daughter Jacqueline, of course, had absolutely no idea what was at stake. Those were more innocent times, and she was an innocent girl. Getting raped by her illustrious president was the furthest thing from her excellent mind. She of his two daughters had inherited her father's brains. Was studying French religiously, because she decided to imitate her father, and go abroad to study medicine at the Faculté de Médecine de Paris. To France. To become the next Madame Curie. Hit the books night and day. And would practice her French with both her father and with their servant, Esteban El Gallo, who'd been born in Haiti and still spoke a pretty good frog. Neither of his daughters had any idea, were as carefree as hobbits, never guessing the shadow that loomed on the horizon. On his days off, when he wasn't at the clinic or in his study, writing, Abelard would stand at his rear window and watch his daughters at their silly children's game until his aching heart could stand it no more. Each morning before Jackie started her studies, she wrote on a clean piece of paper, "Tarde venientibus ossa." To the latecomers are left the bones. He spoke of these matters to only three people. The first, of course, was his wife, Socorro. Socorro, it must be said here, was a talent in her own right. A famous beauty from the East, Igay, and the source of all her daughter's pulchritude. Socorro had looked in her youth like a dark-hued Deja Thoris. One of the chief reasons Abelard had pursued a girl so beneath his class, and was also one of the finest nurse practitioners he'd ever had the honor of working with in Mexico or the Dominican Republic, which, given his estimation of his Mexican colleagues, is no small praise. The second reason he'd gone after her. Her workhorseness and her encyclopedic knowledge of folk cures and traditional remedies made her an indispensable partner in his practice. Her reaction, though, to his Trujillo worries was typical. She was a clever, skilled, hard-working woman who didn't blink when faced with arterial spray hissing from a machete-chopped arm stump. But when it came to more abstract menaces like, say, Trujillo, she stubbornly and willfully refused to acknowledge there might be a problem, all the while dressing Jacqueline in the most suffocating of clothes. "Why are you telling people that I'm loca?" she demanded. He spoke of it as well with his mistress, Señora Lidia Abenader, one of the three women who'd rejected his marriage offer upon his return from his studies in Mexico, now a widow and his number one lover. She was the woman his father had wanted him to bag in the first place. And when he'd been unable to close the deal, his father had mocked him as a half-man, even unto his final days of bilious life. The third reason he'd gone after Socorro. Last, he spoke with his longtime neighbor and friend, Marcus Applegate Roman, whom he often had to ferry back and forth from presidential events because Marcus lacked a car. With Marcus, it had been a spontaneous outburst, the weight of the problem truly pressing on him. They'd been cruising back to La Vega on one of the old marine occupation roads, middle of the night in August, through the black, black farmlands of the Cibao, so hot they had to drive with the windows cranked down, which meant a constant stream of mosquitoes scooting up their nostrils. And out of nowhere, Abelard began to talk. Young women have no opportunity to develop unmolested in this country, he complained. Then he gave as an example the name of a young woman whom the jefe had only recently despoiled. A muchacha known to both of them, a graduate of the University of Florida and the daughter of an acquaintance. At first, Marcus said nothing. In the darkness of the Packard's interior, his face was an absence, a pool of shadow. A worrisome silence. Marcus was no fan of the jefe, having more than once in Abelard's presence called him un bruto y un imbécil, but that didn't stop Abelard from being suddenly aware of his colossal indiscretion. Such was life in those secret police days. Finally, Abelard said, "This doesn't bother you." Marcus hunched down to light a cigarette. And finally his face reappeared, drawn but familiar.
Nothing we can do about it, Abelard.
But imagine you were in similar straits. How would you protect yourself?
I'd be sure to have ugly daughters.
Lydia was far more realistic. She'd been seated at her armoire, brushing her Moorish hair. He'd been lying on the bed, naked as well, absently pulling on his ripio. Lydia had said, "Send her away to the nuns. Send her to Cuba. My family there will take care of her." Cuba was Lydia's dream. It was her Mexico. Always talking about moving back there. "But I'd need permission from the state." "Ask for it then." "But what if el jefe notices the requests?" Lydia put down her brush with a sharp click. "What are the chances of that happening?"
"You never know,"
Abelard said defensively. "In this country, you never know." His mistress was for Cuba, his wife for house arrest. His best friend said nothing. His own cautiousness told him to await further instructions. And at the end of the year, he got them. At one of the interminable presidential events, el jefe had shaken Abelard's hand, but instead of moving on, he paused, a nightmare come true, held on to his fingers and said in his shrill voice,
"You are Dr. Abelard Cabral?"
Abelard bowed.
"At your service, Your Excellency."
In less than a nanosecond, Abelard was drenched in sweat. He knew what was coming next. The failed cattle thief had never spoken more than three words to him his whole life. What else could it be? He dared not glance away from Trujillo's heavily powdered face. But out the corner of his eyes he caught glimpses of the lambesacos, hovering, beginning to realize that an exchange was in the making.
"I have seen you here often, doctor, but lately without your wife. Have you divorced her?"
"I am still married, Your Enormity. Tu socorro, Hernández Batista."
"That is good to hear," el jefe said.
"I was afraid that you might have turned into un maricón."
Then he turned to the lambesacos and laughed.
"Oh, jefe," they screamed. "You are too much."
It was at this point that another nigger might have, in a fit of cojones, said something to defend his honor. But Abelard was not that nigger. He said nothing.
"But of course," el jefe continued, knuckling a tear from his eye, "you are no maricón, for I've heard that you have daughters, Dr. Cabral. Una que es muy bella y elegante, ¿no?"
Abelard had rehearsed a dozen answers to this question, but his response was pure reflex, came out of nowhere.
"Yes, jefe, you are correct. I have two daughters. But to tell you the truth, they're only beautiful if you have a taste for women with mustaches."
For an instant, el jefe had said nothing. And in that twisting silence, Abelard could see his daughter being violated in front of him while he was lowered with excruciating slowness into Trujillo's infamous pool of sharks. But then, miracle of miracles, el jefe had crinkled his porcine face and laughed. Abelard had laughed too, and El Jefe moved on. When Abelard returned home to La Vega late that evening, he woke his wife from a deep slumber so that they could both pray and thank the heavens for their family's salvation. Verbally, Abelard had never been quick on the draw. "The inspiration could only have come from the hidden spaces within my soul," he told his wife. "From a numinous being."
"You mean God?" his wife pressed.
"I mean someone," Abelard said darkly.
End of Disc 6.
And so? For the next 3 months, Abelard waited for the end. Waited for his name to start appearing in the Foro Popular section of the paper, thinly veiled criticisms aimed at a certain bone doctor from La Vega, which was often how the regime began the destruction of a respected citizen such as him, with disses about the way your socks and your shirts didn't match. Waited for a letter to arrive, demanding a private meeting with the jefe. Waited for his daughter to turn up missing on her trip back to school. Lost nearly 20 pounds during his awful vigil. Began to drink copiously. Nearly killed a patient with a slip of the hand. If his wife hadn't spotted the damage before they stitched, who knows what might have happened? Screamed at his daughters and wife almost every day. Couldn't get it up much for his mistress. But the rain season turned to hot season, and the clinic filled with the hapless, the wounded, the afflicted, and when after 4 months nothing happened, Abelard almost let out a sigh of relief. "Maybe," he wrote on the back of his hairy hand. "Maybe." Santo Domingo Confidential. In some ways, living in Santo Domingo during the Trujillato was a lot like being in that famous Twilight Zone episode that Oscar loved so much. The one where the monstrous white kid with the godlike powers rules over a town that is completely isolated from the rest of the world. A town called Peaksville. The white kid is vicious and random, and all the people in the community live in straight terror of him, denouncing and betraying each other at the drop of a hat, in order not to be the person he maims, or, more ominously, sends to the corn. After each atrocity he commits, whether it's giving a gopher 3 heads, or banishing a no longer interesting playmate to the corn, or raining snow down on the last crops, the horrified people of Peaksville have to say, "It was a good thing you did, Anthony. A good thing." Between 1930, when the failed cattle thief seized power, and 1961, the year he got blazed, Santo Domingo was the Caribbean's very own Peaksville, with Trujillo playing the part of Anthony, and the rest of us reprising the role of the man who got turned into Jack in the Box. You might roll your eyes at the comparison, but friends, it would be hard to exaggerate the power Trujillo exerted over the Dominican people, and the shadow of fear he cast throughout the region. Homeboy dominated Santo Domingo like it was his very own private Mordor. Not only did he lock the country away from the rest of the world, isolated behind the Platano Curtain, he acted like it was his very own plantation. Acted like he owned everything and everyone, killed whomever he wanted to kill, sons, brothers, fathers, mothers, took women away from their husbands on their wedding nights, and then would brag publicly about the great honeymoon he'd had the night before. His eye was everywhere. He had a secret police that outstazied the Stasi, that kept watch on everyone, even those everyones who lived in the States. A security apparatus so ridiculously mongoose that you could say a bad thing about El Jefe at 8:40 in the morning, and before the clock struck 10, you'd be in the cuarenta having a cattle prod shoved up your ass. Who says that we third world people are inefficient? It wasn't just Mr. Friday the 13th you had to worry about either. It was the whole Chibato nation he helped spawn,
for like every Dark Lord worth his shadow, he had the devotion of his people. It was widely believed that at any one time between 42% and 87% of the Dominican population was on the secret police's payroll. Your own fucking neighbors could acabar con you just because you had something they coveted, or because you cut in front of them at the colmado. Mad folks went out in that manner, betrayed by those they considered their panas, by members of their own families, by slips of the tongue. One day you were a law-abiding citizen cracking nuts on your galeria. The next day you were in the 40 getting your nuts cracked. Shit was so tight that many people actually believed that Trujillo had supernatural powers. It was whispered that he didn't sleep, didn't sweat, that he could see, smell, feel events hundreds of miles away, that he was protected by the most evil fuku on the island. You wonder why, two generations later, our parents are still so damn secretive. Why you'll find out your brother ain't your brother only by accident. But let's not go completely overboard. Trujillo was certainly formidable, and the regime was like a Caribbean mortar in many ways. But there were plenty of people who despised El Jefe, who communicated in less than veiled ways their contempt, who resisted. But Abelard was simply not one of them. Homeboy wasn't like his Mexican colleagues, who were always keeping up with what was happening elsewhere in the world, who believed that change was possible. He didn't dream of revolution. Didn't care that Trotsky had lived and died not 10 blocks from his student pension in Coyoacán. Wanted only to tend his wealthy, ailing patients, and afterward return to his study, without worrying about being shot in the head or thrown to the sharks. Every now and then, one of his acquaintances, usually Marcus, would describe for him the latest Trujillo atrocity. An affluent clan stripped of its properties and sent into exile. An entire family fed piece by piece to the sharks because a son had dared compare Trujillo to Adolf Hitler before a terrified audience of his peers. A suspicious assassination in Bonao of a well-known unionist. Abelard listened to these horrors tensely, and then, after an awkward silence, would change the subject. He simply didn't wish to dwell on the fates of unfortunate people, on the goings-on in Peaksville. He didn't want those stories in his house. The way Abelard saw it, his Trujillo philosophy, if you will, he only had to keep his head down, his mouth shut, his pockets open, his daughters hidden for another decade or two. By then, he prophesied, Trujillo would be dead and the Dominican Republic would be a true democracy. Abelard, it turned out, needed help in the prophecy department. Santo Domingo never became a democracy. He didn't have no couple of decades either. His luck ran out earlier than anyone expected. The Bad Thing. 1945 should have been a capital year for Abelard and family. Two of Abelard's articles were published to minor acclaim, and he received complimentary responses from a couple of continental doctors, very flattering indeed. Business in the supermercados couldn't have been better. The island was still flush from the war boom, and his managers couldn't keep anything on the shelves. The fincas were producing and reaping profits. The worldwide collapse of agricultural prices was still years off. Abelard had a full load of clients, performed a number of tricky surgeries with impeccable skill. His daughters were prospering. Jacqueline had been accepted at a prestigious boarding school in Le Havre to begin the following year, her chance to escape. His wife and mistress were pouring on the adoration. Even the servants seemed content, not that he ever really spoke to them. All in all, the good doctor should have been immensely satisfied with himself, should have ended each day with his feet up, un cigarro in the corner of his mouth,
and a broad grin creasing his ursine features. It was, dare we say it, a good life. Except it wasn't. In February, there was another presidential event for Independence Day, and this time the invitation was explicit. For Dr. Abelard Luis Cabral, and wife, and daughter Jacqueline. The daughter Jacqueline part had been underlined by the party's host. Not once, not twice, but three times. Abelard nearly fainted when he saw the damn thing. Slumped back at his desk, his heart pushing up against his esophagus. Stared at the vellum square for almost a whole hour before folding it and placing it inside his shirt pocket. The next morning he visited the host, one of his neighbors. The man was out in his corral, staring balefully as some of his servants were trying to get one of the stallions to stud. When he saw Abelard, his face darkened.
What the hell do you want from me? The order came straight from the Palacio.
When Abelard walked back to his car, he tried not to show that he was shaking. Once again, he consulted with Marcus and Lydia. He said nothing of the invitation to his wife, not wanting to panic her, and by extension, his daughter. Not wanting even to say the words in his own house. Where the last time he'd been somewhat rational. This go-around, he was fuera de serie, raved like a madman. Waxed indignant to Marcus for nearly an hour about the injustice, about the hopelessness of it all. An amazing amount of circumlocution because he never once directly named who it was he was complaining about. Alternated between impotent rage and pathetic self-pity. In the end, his friend had to cover the good doctor's mouth to get a word in edgewise, but Abelard kept talking.
It's madness! Sheer madness! I'm the father of my household. I'm the one who says what goes.
What can you do? Marcus said, with no little fatalism. Trujillo is the president and you're just a doctor. If he wants your daughter at the party, you can do nothing but obey.
But this isn't human.
When has this country ever been human, Abelard? You're the historian. You of all people should know that. Lydia was even less compassionate. She read the invite and swore a coño under her breath, and then she turned on him.
I warned you, Abelard. Didn't I tell you to send your daughter abroad while you had the chance? She could have been with my family in Cuba, safe and sound, and now you're jodido. Now he has his eye on you.
I know, Lydia.
But what should I do?
Jesucristo, Abelard, she said tremulously. What options are there? This is Trujillo you're talking about.
Back home, the portrait of Trujillo, which every good citizen had hanging in his house, beamed down on him with insipid, viperous benevolence. Maybe if the doctor had immediately grabbed his daughters and his wife and smuggled them all aboard a boat in Puerto Plata, or if he'd stolen with them across the border into Haiti, they might have had a chance. The Platano curtain was strong, but it wasn't that strong. But alas, instead of making his move, Abelard fretted and temporized and despaired. He couldn't eat, couldn't sleep. Paced the halls of their house all night long, and all the weight he regained these last months, he immediately lost. If you think about it, maybe he should have heeded his daughter's philosophy. Tarde venientibus ossa. Every chance he got, he spent with his daughters. Jackie, who was her parents' golden child, who already had memorized all the streets in the French Quarter, and who that year alone had been the object of not four, not five, but 12 marriage proposals. All communicated to Abelard and his wife, of course, Jackie knowing nothing about it. But still. And Astrid, 10 years old. who took more after their father in looks and nature. Planer, the jokester, the believer, who played the meanest piano in all of the Cibao, and who was her big sister's ally in all things. The sisters wondered about their father's sudden attentiveness.
Are you on vacation, Papi?
He shook his head sadly. No. I just like spending time with you is all.
What's the matter with you?
His wife demanded, but he refused to speak to her. Let me be, mujer. Things got so bad with him that he even went to church, a first for Abelard, which might have been a really bad idea since everybody knew the church at that time was in Trujillo's pocket. He attended confession almost every day and talked to the priest, but he got nothing out of it except to pray and to hope and to light some fucking stupid candles. He was going through 3 bottles of whiskey a day. His friends in Mexico would have grabbed their rifles and taken to the interior. At least, that's what he thought they would have done. But he was his father's son in more ways than he cared to admit. His father, an educated man, who'd resisted sending his son to Mexico, but who'd always played ball with Trujillo. When in 1937 the army had started murdering all the Haitians, his father had allowed them to use his horses, and when he didn't get any of them back, he didn't say nothing to Trujillo, just chalked it up as the cost of doing business. Abelard kept drinking and kept fretting, stopped seeing Lydia, isolated himself in his study, and eventually convinced himself that nothing would happen. It was only a test. Told his wife and daughter to prepare for the party. Didn't mention it was a Trujillo party. Made it seem like nothing was amiss. Hated himself to his core for his mendacity, but what else could he have done? Tarde venientibus ossa. It probably would have gone off without a hitch, too, but Jackie was so excited. Since it was her first big party, who was surprised that it became something of an event for her? She went shopping for a dress with her mother, got her hair done at the salon, bought new shoes, and was even given a pair of pearl earrings by another of her female relatives. Socorro helped her daughter with every aspect of the preparation, no suspicions. But about a week before the party, she started having these terrible dreams. She was in her old town, where she'd grown up before her aunt adopted her and put her in nursing school, before she discovered she had the gift of healing. Staring down that dusty, frangipani-lined road that everybody said led to the capital, and in the heat-rippled distance, she could see a man approaching. A distant figure who struck in her such dread that she woke up screaming. Abelard leaping out of bed in panic, the girls crying out in their rooms. Had that dream almost every damn night that final week. A countdown clock. On T-2, Lydia urged Abelard to leave with her on a steamer bound for Cuba. She knew the captain. He would hide them. Swore it could be done. We'll get your daughters afterward, I promise you. I can't. Do that, he said miserably. I can't leave my family. She returned to combing her hair. They said not another word. On the afternoon of the party, as Abelard was dolefully tending to the car, he caught sight of his daughter in her dress, standing in the sala, hunched over another one of her French books. Looking absolutely divine, absolutely young. And right then he had one of those epiphanies us lit majors are always forced to talk about. It didn't come in a burst of light, or a new color, or a sensation in his heart. He just knew. Knew he just couldn't do it. Told his wife to forget about it. Said same to daughter. Ignored their horrified protestations. Jumped in the car, picked up Marcus, and headed to the party. What about Jacqueline? Marcus asked. She's not coming. Marcus shook his head. Said nothing else. At the reception line, Trujillo again paused before Abelard, sniffed the air like a cat.
And your wife and daughter?
Abelard, trembling but holding it together somehow, already sensing how everything was going to change.
My apologies, Your Excellency. They could not attend.
His porcine eyes narrowed.
So I see,
he said coldly, and then dismissed Abelard with a flick of his wrist. Not even Marcus would look at him. Chiste Apocalyptus. Not 4 weeks after the party, Dr. Abelard Luis Cabral was arrested by the secret police. The charge? Slander and gross calumny against the person of the president. If the stories are to be believed, it all had to do with a joke. One afternoon, so the story goes, shortly after the fateful party, Abelard, who we had better reveal was a short-bearded, heavy-set man with surprising physical strength and curious, close-set eyes, drove into Santiago in his old Packard to buy a bureau for his wife, and of course to see his mistress. He was still a mess, and those who saw him that day recall his disheveled appearance, his distraction. The bureau was successfully acquired and lashed haphazardly to the roof of the automobile, but before he could shoot over to Lydia's crib, Abelard was buttonholed by some buddies on the street and invited for a few drinks at Club Santiago. Who knows why he went? Maybe to try to keep up appearances, or because every invitation felt like a life-or-death affair. That night at Club Santiago, he tried to shake off his sense of imminent doom by talking vigorously about history, medicine, Aristophanes, by getting very, very drunk, and when the night wound down, he asked the boys for assistance in relocating the bureau to the trunk of his Packard. He didn't trust the valets, he explained, for they had stupid hands. The muchachos good-naturedly agreed. But while Abelard was fumbling with the keys to open the trunk, he stated loudly, "I hope there aren't any bodies in here." That he made the foregoing remark is not debated. Abelard conceded as much in his confession. This trunk joke in itself caused discomfort among the boys, who were all too aware of the shadow that the Packard automobile casts on Dominican history. It was the car in which Trujillo had, in his early years, terrorized his first two elections away from the Pueblo. During the hurricane of 1931, the jefe's henchmen often drove their Packards to the bonfires where the volunteers were burning the dead, and out of their trunks they would pull out victims of the hurricane, all of whom looked strangely dry and were often clutching opposition party materials. The wind, the henchmen would joke, drove a bullet straight through the head of this one. Har har. What followed is still, to this day, hotly disputed. There are those who swear on their mothers that when Abelard finally opened the trunk, he poked his head inside and said, "Nope, nobody's here." This is what Abelard himself claimed to have said. A poor joke, certainly, but not slander or gross calumny. In Abelard's version of the events, his friends laughed, the bureau was secured, and off he drove to his Santiago apartment, where Lydia was waiting for him, 42 and still lovely and still worried shitless about his daughter. The court officers and their hidden witnesses, however, argued that something quite different happened. That when Dr. Abelard Luis Cabral opened the trunk of the Packard, he said, "Nope, nobody's here. Trujillo must have cleaned them out for me." End quote. In my humble opinion, it sounds like the most unlikely load of jeringonza on this side of the Sierra Madre. But one man's jeringonza is another man's life. The Fall.
He spent that night with Lydia. It had been a weird time for them. Not 10 days earlier, Lydia had announced that she was pregnant. "I'm going to have your son," she crowed happily. But 2 days later, the son proved to be a false alarm, probably just some indigestion. There was relief, like he needed anything else on his plate, and what if it had been another daughter? But also disappointment, for Abelard wouldn't have minded a little son, even if the carajito would have been the child of a mistress and born in his darkest hour. He knew that Lydia had been wanting something for some time now, something real that she could claim was theirs and theirs alone. She was forever telling him to leave his wife and move in with her. And while that might have been attractive indeed while they were together in Santiago, the possibility vanished as soon as he set foot back in his house and his two beautiful daughters rushed him. He was a predictable man and liked his predictable comforts. But Lydia never stopped trying to convince him in a low-intensity way that love was love, and for that reason, it should be obeyed. She pretended to be sanguine over the non-appearance of their son. "Why would I want to ruin these breasts?" she joked. But he could tell she was disheartened. He was too. For these last few days, Abelard had been having vague, troubled dreams full of children crying at night, and his father's first house left a disquieting stain on his waking hours. Without really thinking about it, he'd not seen Lydia since that night the news turned bad. Had gone out drinking in part, I believe, because he feared that the boy's non-birth might have broken them. But instead, he felt for her the old desire, the one that nearly knocked him over the first time they'd met at his cousin Amilcar's birthday, when they'd both been so slender and young and so jam-packed with possibilities. For once, they didn't talk about Trujillo. "Can you believe how long it's been?" he asked her in amazement during their last Saturday night tryst. "I can believe it," she said sadly, pulling at the flesh of her stomach. "We're clocks, Abelard. Nothing more." Abelard shook his head. "We're more than that. We're marvels, mi amor. I wish I could stay in this moment, wish I could extend Abelard's happy days, but it's impossible." The next week, two atomic eyes opened over civilian centers in Japan, and even though no one knew it yet, the world was then remade. Not 2 days after the atomic bombs scarred Japan forever, Socorro dreamed that the faceless man was standing over her husband's bed, and she could not scream, could not say anything. And then the next night she dreamed that he was standing over her children too. "I've been dreaming," she told her husband, but he waved his hands, dismissing. She began to watch the road in front of their home and burn candles in her room. In Santiago, Abelard is kissing Lydia's hands and she is sighing with pleasure, and already we're heading for victory in the Pacific, and for three secret police officers in their shiny Chevrolet winding up the road to Abelard's house. Already, it's the fall. Abelard in chains. To say it was the greatest shock in Abelard's life when officers from the secret police, it's too early for the sim, but we'll call them sim anyway, placed him in cuffs and led him to their car, wouldn't be an overstatement. If it wasn't for the fact that Abelard was going to spend the next 9 years receiving one greatest shock of his life after another. "Please," Abelard begged when he regained his tongue. "I must leave my wife a note." "Manuel will attend to it," Simeon Numero Uno explained, motioning to the largest of the Simeons, who was already glancing about the house. Abelard's last glimpse of his home was of Manuel rifling through his desk with a practiced carelessness. Abelard had always imagined the sim to be filled with lowlifes and no reading reprobates. But the two officers who locked him in their car were in fact polite, less like sadistic torturers than vacuum cleaner salesmen. Simeon Numero Uno assured him en route that his difficulties were certain to be cleared up.
"We've seen these cases before," Numero Uno explained. "Someone has spoken badly of you, but they will quickly be revealed for the liars they are."
"I should hope so," Abelard said, half indignant, half in terror.
"No te preocupes," said Simeon Numero Uno. "The jefe is not in the business of imprisoning the innocent."
Numero Dos remained silent. His suit was very shabby, and both men, Abelard noticed, reeked of whiskey. He tried to remain calm. Fear, as Dune teaches us, is the mind killer. But he couldn't help himself. He saw his daughters and his wife raped over and over again. He saw his house on fire. If he hadn't emptied his bladder right before the pigs showed up, he would have peed himself right there. Abelard was driven very quickly to Santiago. Everyone he passed on the road made sure to look away, and taken to the Fortaleza San Luis. The sharp edge of his fear turned knife once they pulled inside that notorious place.
"Are you sure this is correct?"
Abelard was so frightened his voice quaked.
"Don't worry, doctor," Numero Dos said. "You are where you belong."
He'd been silent so long, Abelard had almost forgotten that he could speak. Now it was Numero Dos who was smiling, and Numero Uno who focused his attention out the window. Once inside those stone walls, the polite sim officers handed him over to a pair of not-so-polite guards, who stripped him of his shoes, his wallet, his belt, his wedding band, and then sat him down in a cramped hot office to fill out some forms. There was a pervasive smell of ripe ass in the air. No officer appeared to explain his case, no one listened to his requests, and when he began to raise his voice about his treatment, the guard typing the forms leaned forward and punched him in the face, as easily as you might reach over for a cigarette. The man was wearing a ring, and it tore open Abelard's lips something awful. The pain was so sudden, his disbelief so enormous, that Abelard actually asked, through clutched fingers, "Why?" The guard rocked him again hard, carved a furrow in his forehead.
"This is how we answer questions around here," the guard said matter-of-factly, bending down to be sure his form was properly aligned in the typewriter.
Abelard began to sob, the blood spilling out between his fingers, which the typing guard just loved. He called in his friends from the other offices.
"Look at this one! Look at how much he likes to cry!"
Before Abelard knew what was happening, he was being shoved into a general holding cell that stank of malaria sweat and diarrhea, and was crammed with unseemly representatives of what Broca might have called the criminal class. The guards then proceeded to inform the other prisoners that Abelard was a homosexual and a communist.
"That is untrue," Abelard protested.
But who is going to listen to a gay comunista? Over the next couple of hours, Abelard was harassed lovely, and most of his clothes were stripped from him. One heavyset cibaeño even demanded his underwear. And when Abelard coughed them up, the man pulled them on over his pants.
"Son muy cómodos,"
he announced to his friends. Abelard was forced to hunker naked near the shit pots. If he tried to crawl near the dry areas, the other prisoners would scream at him.
"Quédate ahí con la mierda, maricón!"
And this was how he had to sleep, amidst urine, feces, and flies. And more than once he was awakened by someone tickling his lips with a dried turd. Preoccupation with sanitation was not high among the Fortalezanos. The deviants didn't allow him to eat either, stealing his meager allotted portions 3 days straight. On the fourth day, a one-armed pickpocket took pity on him, and he was able to eat an entire banana without interruption, even tried to chew up the fibrous peel, he was so famished. Poor Abelard.